That same day, a Benjaminite ran from the battle line and went to Shiloh, with his clothes torn and dust on his head. When he arrived, there was Eli sitting on his chair by the side of the road, watching, because his heart feared for the ark of God. When the man entered the town and told what had happened, the whole town sent up a cry. Eli heard the outcry and asked, "What is the meaning of this uproar?" The man hurried over to Eli, who was 98 years old and whose eyes had failed so that he could not see. He told Eli, "I have just come from the battle line. I fled from it this very day." Eli asked, "What happened, my son?" The man who brought the news replied, "Israel fled before the Philistines, and the army has suffered heavy losses. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured." When he mentioned the Ark of God, Eli fell backwards off his chair by the side of the gate. His neck was broken, and he died, for he was an old man, and he was heavy. He had led Israel for 40 years. His daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant and near the time of delivery. When she heard the news that the Ark of God had been captured and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she went into labour and gave birth, but was overcome by her labour pains. As she was dying, the woman attending her said, "Don't despair, you have given birth to a son." But she did not respond or pay any attention. She named the boy Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel because of the capture of the Ark of God and the deaths of her father-in-law and her husband." She said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God has been captured." This is the word of the Lord.
Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for this ancient passage, this ancient story that we're looking at together. We pray that you'd help us to understand it. Would you speak into our hearts by it so that we would know you better and follow you better because of it? Amen. When I was in my 20s, my department at work organised an away day for team building. It's really just a bunch of youth group games that you'd play in Frog, but organised by really expensive management consultants. And one of them was an egg drop. I don't know if you've ever done an egg drop. You're given this raw egg and a few basic craft materials. So you've got paper and straws and string and sellotape and usually a few useless things like those little lolly sticks that nobody ever knows what to do with. And you have to find a way to drop the egg from a first floor balcony onto usually a rather dismal concrete car park floor without the shell smashing. And my group was the geekiest one, which won't surprise you. And this was a university medical physics department, so the baseline geekiness level is quite high anyway. And instead of the conventional padded box, we made this really elaborate paper aeroplane with the egg balanced on top. And it worked beautifully. It glided down from the balcony to a safe landing. We didn't win, though. Eggs are pretty heavy, and to avoid unbalancing our plane, we'd made a tiny pinhole in each end of it and blown the contents out in the bathroom before the competition. So what we had was a perfectly formed eggshell, and we almost got away with it because it looked exactly the same, but unfortunately one of the very expensive management consultants got suspicious and inspected it a bit too closely, and we were disqualified for cheating. Our rather dismal passage today is a place where Israel's religion turns out to be a bit like that egg. It's impressive from the outside. It looks exactly like everyone else's. But it turns out to be completely empty. When you inspect it closely or you give it a squeeze, it turns out to be a sham. There's nothing inside. It is a fragile shell. We'll keep that picture in mind, if you would, as we work through the passage, because we'll come back to it later. But in this dismal passage, what we see is an old man and a young widow who both die after receiving news of a battle. In case you missed the family service last week, it's a battle between the Israelites and the Philistines. The Philistines are a nearby hostile nation, and Israel lose the first skirmish with them to the tune of 4,000 men. So they increase their odds, or they think they do, by bringing the Ark of God with them to the battlefield. The Ark is this special container which symbolizes God's presence and his promises to the people. So they bring it to the battlefield, and the Israelites make loads of noise. They're really confident, and the Philistines are terrified, and things look really good. And then in verse 10, we read, "So the Philistines fought, and the Israelites were defeated, and every man fled to his tent," which is really just a way of saying the army disbanded. "The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. The Ark of God was captured, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died." And then one disheveled soldier runs back with the news from the battlefield to temple headquarters at Shiloh. That's verse 12. It's probably about 20 miles, so you can just about do it in a day if you're fit. And he relays the news to the town, probably in the center of town, and the whole town cries out in verse 13 with this cry of despair. And the passage then zooms in on two specific people receiving the news. It's Eli, who's the senior priest. We've met him before in 1 Samuel. And his daughter-in-law, whose name we never learn. What I want to do is spend most of our time just walking through the detail of those two encounters and make sure we've noticed everything that the Bible writer wants us to. And then we'll come back at the end and draw two conclusions from it. So let's look at our two characters. The first is the old man, Eli, in verses 12 to 18. Now, he's no spring chicken. He's 98 years old and can't see. He's blind, verse 15. But he's still the spiritual leader of Israel. And the job of the spiritual leader, well, one of their jobs was to sit in an official seat by the gate and be available for people to ask for decisions. And that's what he's doing here. He's sitting by the gate, waiting anxiously for news of the battle. I guess he's blind, so I guess he can't see the runner go fast the first time. But he hears the cry of dismay from the center of town. Maybe smells the dirt and blood and ashes on the guy who's run by. And he asks what it means, verse 14. And you know, it's that awful moment when you know the news is bad, but you don't know yet how bad. You don't know the detail. Perhaps you've had that. Your face goes cold. So he has to ask twice, verses 14 and 16, what's happened, because the messenger, I think perhaps after verse 14, doesn't quite have the heart to tell him. But after verse 16, he does. And in verse 17, the messenger says, "Israel fled before the Philistines, and the army has suffered heavy losses. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured." Must have been terrible, mustn't it? It piles on more and more bad news. The battle's been lost, the army's disbanded, your sons died as well, and the Ark of God's been captured. And Eli, in shock, falls to the ground. And as sadly often happens with the very elderly, he injures his spine and dies. I want to think a little bit about the three different layers of grief that Eli experiences there. I think it's too much for him, isn't it, the grief? But I think there's three different layers of it. There's this national grief of large-scale slaughter. And then there's a personal grief that his two sons are among them. And then there's, if you like, a theological grief about the Ark being captured. So let's look at each of those briefly. First of all, the national grief. The writer records 34,000 deaths across the two battles. We don't quite understand the word thousand in the Old Testament. But later in 2 Samuel 24, King David's census records, using similar language, over 1 million able-bodied men in the army. So if we take those two numbers as proportionate to each other, that would really be somebody in every family. That would be every family having a death. Somebody's brother or father or uncle or husband or son who never came home that day after the battle. Every family in Israel experiences something like the verses we've just read. Now, let me be clear that this passage isn't about the rights and wrongs of war. It doesn't say anything about why these two nations were fighting. Actually, we don't know which, if either of them, had a just cause. and where the selfishness that David talked about earlier was sitting. It would be a mistake to try and apply it that way. But it does remind us of the cost of human selfishness and conflict. On Remembrance Sunday, perhaps that's an appropriate thing to flag. 70 to 85 million people died in World War II, about 3% of the whole global population at the time, the deadliest conflict in history. And of those, 2/3 were civilians, not soldiers. The cost of human selfishness and aggression is always terrible. So that's the national grief. But second, there's the personal grief. The writer emphasises twice here that Eli's sons Hophni and Phinehas died the same day. It's in verses 11 and 12, just across the beginning of our passage, then 16 and 17. And each pair of verses does the same thing. It says their names, and then it underlines that the whole thing took place inside 24 hours. If we've been paying attention to 1 Samuel, that should ring a bell from chapter 2, just one page back. You might want to turn to it. Hophni and Phinehas were scoundrels. That's the language the Bible uses in 2:12, taking the best parts of the sacrifices, having sex with the temple servants. And as leaders of Israel, that was a terrible thing. They were setting an awful example for the people. And Eli, who's their father and the senior leader of Israel, doesn't stop them beyond a kind of a cursory telling off. So God judges Eli's whole family for that in chapter 2, verse 34. Have a look at it with me. This is God speaking. And what happens to your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, will be a sign to you. They will both die on the same day. I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who will do according to what is in my heart. I will firmly establish his priestly house, and they will minister before my anointed one always. And then in chapter 3, God repeats it to Samuel. In 3 verses 11 to 13, I'll paraphrase it. I'm about to carry out against Eli everything I spoke against his family because of the sin he knew about. This was grievous before God. And the writer wants us to join the dots between chapters 2 and 3 and what happens in chapter 4. This is not just a sad story. This is God acting in judgment. Now, read in context, that means there is also some hope hidden inside this passage. Because if God keeps his promise to deal with evil leadership, that means he is keeping his promise to create faithful leadership, the faithful priest we just heard about. Last year, my family went on a short holiday at half term, and my younger daughter, Kessia, who likes climbing, fell off the monkey bars of an unfamiliar climbing frame and cut her chin underneath quite badly. It wasn't life-threatening or anything like that, but it was deep enough to need an A&E visit, and we took her off to the local hospital. And the cut was very sore, so before they closed it up with glue, much better than the stitches of my childhood, it's all done with super glue now, before they closed it up, the very kind nurse offered to put a numbing gel on the cut. And she warned Kessia that the gel would really, really hurt to start with, just for the first few moments as it was on her face. And to judge by Kessia's face and subsequent noises from when they put it on, I think that was probably accurate. But over the next few minutes, the pain went away, and then they were able to close up the cut properly, and it's healed beautifully. You can hardly see it. Well, the Bible is sometimes that way. The story is incredibly painful. But in the context, when we see the bigger picture, we see that God is working to deal with a greater evil and to bring about a greater good. 1 Samuel 4 is painful. It's desperately painful for Eli's family. But it is what stops the evil of Hophni and Phinehas. It is what appoints the priest Samuel and then later the King David and the family line that leads to Jesus, the priest who will serve faithfully forever. So there is a note of hope in this dismal story. That's the personal grief. But then third, there is a theological grief here. In verse 13, as Eli waits for the news, it's not the army or even his sons at the top of his thoughts, but his fear for the ark of God. Did you notice that in verse 13? And then in verse 18, when he falls off the chair and dies, that happens at the mention of the Ark of God. We're told that in verse 18. Now, we talked last week, if you were here at the family service, about Israel's hubris in taking the Ark into battle. They thought they could force God's hand or twist God's arm, perhaps, into making them win, because God wouldn't want to allow a humiliating defeat with his ark there. They thought God wouldn't let that happen. And with him present, he would be like plonking a super powerful weapon in the middle of the battlefield that would guarantee them victory. But because God won't have his arm twisted that way, well, the headlines in the media, especially the Philistine media, I guess, will be exactly what the Israelites assumed God would not allow. It will be that God does look weak right now, that God is defeated. The Philistines, I assume straight after the battle, would pick up the ark and carry it home cheering and jeering about Yahweh and proclaiming that their god, Dagon, had turned out to be stronger than the pathetic Israelite god. It's perhaps a little bit like an American football team carrying off the opposing team's mascot and desecrating it. I had a short work trip to Wisconsin earlier this year, and the town Madison was full of enthusiastic people, each waving a big badger above their head. Apparently the badger is the local mascot of the football team. And, of course, thinking about God as a victory-bringing mascot is exactly the problem here, isn't it? You can picture it happening. Well, for Israel's priest leader, that theological grief of a humiliated God cuts the deepest. And so in verse 18, Eli dies. His epitaph is that he had led Israel, or judged Israel, the same word, for 40 years. And in the end, it's probably worth saying that Eli is a bit of a mixed character, isn't he? It's hard to know how to feel about him. The writer has deliberately used that honouring title of judge. It's the same one you get in the book of Judges with great people like Gideon and Deborah and Samson. And Eli has shown great concern for the honour of the Ark of the Lord in this passage. And he has been wise and godly with Hannah and Samuel in the chapters before. But at the same time, he's been too afraid to stop his own son's blatant wickedness destroying the nation's spiritual leadership. Perhaps there is a warning in there for those of us with the double privilege of leadership and parenthood in church today, to keep a godly priority on how we behave in our own families. Well, let's leave Eli for now and look at the last bit of the story and the young woman. She's never named in the passage. She's the wife of Phinehas, who in verse 19 finds out that she's a widow. It's 19 to 22. Well, she's a widow and she's pregnant, and it seems that the news shocks her into premature labour. Her baby son survives, but she doesn't. I guess much of what I've just said about Eli is true of her in this passage as well. The national grief, the personal grief for her family, the sign of God's judgment, she would have known about that, and the theological grief of the captured ark. But let's think about her death just for a moment. We're fortunate that death in childbirth is now relatively rare in the UK. My family have two kids, and I have to say the process certainly didn't look comfortable, but it's not often fatal in England. Much of the world isn't so lucky. If you look at a map, there are parts of Central Africa where as many as 1 in 100 live births still result in the death of the mother. In the UK, it's less than 1 in 10,000. I work in healthcare during the week, and there's a clear moral imperative to keep addressing that kind of inequality. But those numbers we've talked about and the danger that exists and the story of this passage should remind the Christian that the physical world is intrinsically damaged by sin. All of us suffer the collateral of sin. We don't know if this young woman had encouraged or joined in her husband's wickedness. The Bible doesn't give us any reason to think so. It doesn't say anything about it. Indeed, as Del Ralph Davis says she probably taught more theology in death than Phineas did in his whole life. None of his sermons are included in the Bible for us today. Hers is. But what she suffers here are the ripple effects of sin, both of her husband's evil and the wider curse of the fall in Genesis 3, where childbirth becomes a cause of suffering. In medicine, some infections are said to be local. You might have an infected cut in your thumb from, you know, doing the wrong thing when you're chopping carrots, or an ear infection or a throat infection. But other times we talk about systemic infections. Those are the ones that are just everywhere, in your blood, all the way throughout your body. And sin in the Bible is like a systemic infection. It's everywhere. Everybody's part of it and everybody suffers from it, even when you can't draw one-to-one lines in every case. And so we cry out for God to fix that. And that's what's beginning to happen in this passage. God is beginning to fulfill his promise to deal with sin and to create a better life. And then there's that final piece of theology, isn't there, from this young woman. She names her child Ichabod in verse 21. It's a great name. And the Hebrew meaning is something like no glory, or where is the glory? And then she says, you know, in case we hadn't picked up the Hebrew, she says in verse 22, the glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured. The Bible writer wants us to understand in every event that happens here, however sad the deaths, that Yahweh himself has been humiliated and shamed. And that is the worst part of this terrible day. God shamed by his people's evil. Well, in our last few minutes, I want to apply this strange and rather sad story in two ways. I want to offer a challenge about God's glory and a comfort from God's shame. Let's start with the challenge about God's glory. Look again at verse 22. Perhaps we can stick it on the screen again. The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured. Which order do you think those two events happened in? Which way round do you think they happened? Did God's glory depart because the ark was captured? Or was the ark captured because God's glory had already gone? Perhaps a way to think about answering that question is to imagine what would have happened if the Israelites had won on the battlefield with the ark. I'm sure they would have carried the ark home triumphant, cheering for Yahweh all the way. But who do you think they would really have been praising? You know why they took the ark there. Do you think it's really Yahweh's honour on their minds? Or is it perhaps their own for deploying such a powerful weapon at just the right time? It's a little bit like the American football team again, isn't it? Perhaps carrying the Badger mascot on their shoulders through the town. Of course, they don't really think the Badger gets the honour and the glory. It's just a proxy for their own pride. It's like the empty egg from my silly illustration at the start. It looks a lot like religion, but there is no Yahweh inside. His glory has departed. It's just a fragile shell which shatters under pressure. I suspect the ark was captured and God allowed it to be captured because Israel had already forsaken God's glory. And I wonder how much of our own religious activity should be stamped Ichabod as well. Where is the glory? When I get on my knees to pray, am I asking to serve my Maker with a capital M? Or am I looking to twist his arm and get what I want from him? I may believe God is very powerful, but do I really understand he is sovereign over me, that I'm his creature, not the other way around? If I'm honest, as I was preparing this, I think my own prayers are often quite shameful in that area. Often I want something from God. Rarely do I want to know what he wants of me. It's not a bad reason, incidentally, to physically get on your knees sometimes when you're praying. It's a good way to remind yourself who is in charge. So there's the challenge, to consider whose glory we seek. And then, as I finish, the comfort of God's shame. It is striking in this passage that when Israel trot out the ark to try and force God's hand into victory, God chooses defeat. Isn't that striking? The Philistine media will say that God was not strong enough, but we know better from the passage. God has chosen humiliation and the capture of his ark to keep his promise from chapter 2 to judge Hophni and Phinehas and to restore honour and order to Israel's worship and to cause them to begin to seek him again. Does that image and that language remind you of anything? The God who chooses to be brought low, shamed, beaten, humbled, defeated and carried off by evil men in order to stop sin and restore a right relationship with himself. Isn't that exactly what the cross is 3,000 years later? Where Jesus chooses to be shamed and flogged and humbled and defeated and crucified by evil men in order to stop sin and restore a right relationship with himself. And of course, when we see it that way, we find that God's glory is not dimmer when the ark is carried off, but brighter. Brighter still, because what looks like defeat will turn out to be victory. There is a great comfort in the God who will bear shame for us. And I want to close by reading a bit of Philippians 2, which is the reality, the undercurrent behind this sad passage. So let me finish with those words. This is Philippians chapter 2. Jesus, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow. Amen.